Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today we talk about what's happened over the past year in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, particularly as it relates to the use of BTK inhibitors. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Jennifer Brown from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts, and Dr. Wojciech Jurczak from the Marie Curie National Research Institute of Oncology in Krakow, Poland. Today we're here to talk about CLL, and as always, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and regimens, so check out the package inserts for more information. As we do in all of our programs, I met with each one of the faculty separately to record a presentation that goes through the key papers that occurred over this past year. Those are also posted in the chat room if you want to look at it now. But when we send out the webinar, we'll also send these out. And really today we're here to talk about sort of what these papers meant. If you want to get into more detail about exactly what each one of them did, then check out the presentation. They really are extremely informative. It also gave me a chance to sit down with both of our faculty after their presentations and query them a little bit about some of the many things that are going on in CLL, and that really helped me develop the platform for what we're going to do here tonight. Here are the papers that are presented in these separate presentations. This is from Wojciech. You can see a whole bunch of papers. Of course, a lot of these come from Ash, as well as Jennifer as well. And so again, all these papers are in their talks. But here's what we're going to do here today. We're going to start out with a little bit of biology and pharmacology intro. We're going to spend most of our time talking about the implications of some of the new data in first-line treatment, also some of the ongoing clinical trials and questions that are being looked at there. And then we'll finish out talking about relapse or refractory disease. So I'm calling this introduction, I think I missed that day in med school, but actually, I don't think we covered this when I was a medical student or even had dreams about it. But it's always good to take a breath. We know we have a lot of people who are new to oncology. About 30% of our audience has been either fellows or been in oncology less than 5 years. So I thought we could just take a breath. And this is a really cool slide that Wojciech uses in his presentation, talking about hazard rates and p-values and particularly comparing different treatments. And of course, the theme there is these new targeted therapies that we have. You see very impressive hazard rates and very impressive data. And of course, the challenge often is indirectly comparing them. But just to take a little bit of a step back, I just put up here, you know, some of the common therapies that have been and are being utilized and hopefully will be utilized in the future in CLL. Jennifer, maybe you can take a shot at just talking a little bit about how you, maybe with your fellows who are starting out in July, just getting started, how you talk to them about sort of what your vision is about the normal function of Bruton's tyrosine kinase in general, normal cells, but in particular, how these different mechanisms of action intersect as we treat CLL. Any sort of general thoughts, Jennifer?
Right. Well, so we actually have a disease in which Bruton tyrosine kinase is deleted. And we know from patients who have that disease that there's a failure of B cell development and they have hypogammaglobulinemia because they don't have any B cells. And so that really underscores the importance of BTK in the development of B cells. And also indicates that it's a good target because these patients don't have a lot of other side effects. They really just lack their B cells and don't have immunoglobulins. And so that is the basis for targeting BTK potentially. In CLL, it's overexpressed and overactive from continuous stimulation through the B cell receptor. So again, a good target.
So, Wojciech, can you talk, maybe add on to that, but also talk a little bit at a basic level about how these various systemic therapies actually work in terms of inhibiting CLL cells, and also maybe a little bit about your vision about the difference between covalent and non-covalent BTKIs.
Well, Bruton thyroxine kinase is a non-receptor thyroxine kinase, which plays a central role in B-cell receptor signaling. Well, this is important because the action on other cells is negligible. If we have adverse events of BTK inhibitors, it's usually due to off-target inhibition and not to the BTK, to the Bruton thyroxine kinase inhibition as such. Off-target inhibition means that our drugs, however magnificent they are, they do not only block BTK, they block other TEC kinases, which may cause some adverse events. That's why ibrutinib was a breakthrough. That was the first approved drug. That was the revolution. That's like a stone wheel. But who cares about stone wheels once we have a modern wooden or even a racing wheels at the moment? If we are talking about the second generation BTK inhibitors, they are more selective, they have less off-target inhibition, and therefore less adverse events, less people who has to stop therapy due to adverse events. So although they are not dramatically more effective in terms of biological effect, we may use them longer. Now, just talking about BTK inhibition, if you are talking about signaling, if the cell has no signal, it's not agitated, it doesn't have a target, it dies of negligence. So that's a very fine way of clearing the organism of the cells we don't want to. In CLL, we don't see a proliferation of the cells. It's rather the cells who are surviving too long. Therefore, it makes one of the best targets we have for this kind of therapy. Now, BCL2 inhibitors, that's the other story.
Yeah, go ahead, please. You want to comment on BCL2 inhibitors? Wojciech?
Basically, these are the drugs which promote apoptosis. So again, they are very useful because if we use chemotherapy, and we are using less and less in indolent lymphomas and in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, we are not killing the cells. We are damaging the cell, and the damaged cell activates the pre-programmed mechanism of its own death. Very elegant, very energy efficient, good for the other cells, not producing inflammation, not producing a lot of energy loss for the organism. Now, if apoptosis is blocked, we have a problem. And if we have certain mutations, like P53 mutations, then switching on apoptosis may be difficult, and venetoclax overcomes it. So therefore, it's another very elegant way of swiping out the unwanted cells out of our organism.
Jennifer, what about the immune effects of BTK inhibitors we see, you know, ibrutinib combined or utilized in patients getting CAR T therapy? What do we know about the impact of the immune impact of BTKIs?
Right. So CLL patients at baseline have a variety of immune defects, including expansion of their T cells and exhaustion of their T cells, which it has an adverse impact on fighting infection and also an adverse impact on the ability of cells to be collected and used to generate CAR Ts. Now, ibrutinib actually inhibits ITK, which in theory could have an impact on improving T cell function. But what we see in practice is that acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib also improve the immune system over the first 6 months to a year of therapy, similar to what we see with ibrutinib. So this has suggested that it may be more from the substantial reduction in the disease burden that these drugs achieve that allows normalization of the immune system than it is from inhibiting ITK, which is just an effect of ibrutinib.
So one final question about this, Wojciech. We're seeing a lot of exciting data coming out now with BTK degraders. Can you comment on your vision about how they work? You know, I was showing you that we were doing this, doing a program coming up in breast cancer and selective estrogen receptor down regulators, SERDs. And there, even though it's billed that, you know, these agents get rid of the receptor. It also seems like it also has a competitive effect. Anyhow, what's your vision of how BTK degraders work, Wojciech?
BTK inhibitors just inhibit the enzyme. They might stop being effective. The degraders just chop it into pieces. Therefore, they used to be more effective. Now, we have early fascinating results with BTK degraders. I'm saying early fascinating results because although the drugs are approved in relapsing refractory setting, and perhaps they might be improved even in combination therapies, we do not yet have a long-time observation. My first comment is that we had a way of thinking that we can use the first-generation BTK inhibitors, then followed, if the patient is having adverse events, by second-generation BTK inhibitors, presumably if they develop resistance, then the third generation, which is pirtobrutinib, and then perhaps BTK degraders. But that might not be the truth, because if we endlessly block the same pathway, the cancer may just overcome it and create another ways of propagating itself. Therefore, there might be the situation in future where we will not use sequentially all generations of BTK inhibitors. We'll just go for the best-in-class inhibitor, even in the first line, and then it might be followed, if approved, by BTK degraders.
So we'll get more into that later, including some of the new data, some of the data that's first starting to come out. So here's where we're heading. We're going to spend most of our time talking about first-line treatment. So much to talk about. There are so many trials that you two both went through. But really want to focus on some of the questions that came up as you discussed it. And we'll talk about relapse disease towards the end of the conference. I put together a series of questions that I actually made slides of that I'm going to bring up to you after I met with both of you. I only have 28 questions for you to deal with here in this next hour. Just kidding. I do have 28 questions. I don't know if we're going to get through them all, but we'll get through as many as we probably should have had 2 hours for this, but we'll take a shot at trying to get into that. And I want to just start out, instead of, going through every single trial, just take a breath before we get into some of the clinical questions that come up from these data and get some of your broad takes, particularly about what happened at ASH, in terms of CLL papers in general, particularly these are related to first-line therapy. So I'm going to ask first you, Jennifer, to comment in terms of non-covalent BTK studies presented at ASH and that's come out over this past year. And just looking at this list, and then I'm going to ask Wojciech to talk about pirtobrutinib and some of the work, including his work that was presented at ASH and has come out over the past year. But Jennifer, when you take a look back and think about what's happened at ASH, can you comment on some of the big papers? Of course, CLL17 had a lot of prominence there, but globally, what are some of the key papers in terms of covalent BTK that came out in terms of what they showed and what you think it meant globally?
Right. Well, CLL17 is definitely the most important, a long-awaited trial. Our first comparison of continuous BTK inhibition with ibrutinib to our two primary time-limited regimens. So that's 1 year of venetoclax with obinutuzumab or 15 months of ibrutinib with venetoclax. And this was designed as a non-inferiority study comparing each of the time-limited arms to the continuous ibrutinib arm. And what was found at relatively early follow-up, it's only 3-year follow-up, which is still a little early, the two time-limited regimens, each one was individually non-inferior to ibrutinib. And in fact, they essentially had overlapping progression-free survival curves in the overall population at about 80% at 3 years. We're not yet seeing much differentiation based on prognostic markers, with the exception of the 17p deleted highest risk group, where it was the case that ibrutinib appeared to perform better than ibrutinib venetoclax, which appeared to perform better than venetoclax obinutuzumab, although the differences were not at this point statistically significant.
So, Wojciech, any comments about Amplify? We saw some more data at ASH. Of course, we saw the Amplify data last year. It seems like a long time ago, but I guess it was last year. We also saw some data looking at sonrotoclax and ibrutinib at the ASH meeting. Again, a time-limited BTK and BCL2 inhibitor. Anything you want to say about that strategy and particularly Amplify and what your thoughts were about some of the data that's been presented?
Well, thanks for this question, because Amplify actually is the study which possibly will guide us through, will serve us as a standard of care in the next couple of years. It's the combination of acalabrutinib and venetoclax, which looks like an absolute winner, because we actually compared both acalabrutinib with venetoclax to acalabrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab. So doublet, we combined doublet and triplet. And unfortunately, it occurred that although in triplet we had a better response rate, there were more adverse events, which may jeopardize the usage of a scheme in the general public. But on the other hand, if we look at our previous experience, it may occur, like an ELEVATE study, where the more aggressive therapy, although with only moderate difference in progression-free survival on the long-time run, occurred to be superior in overall survival. Now, well, I'm saying that AV regimen is supposed to be the best time-limited regimen we can offer nowadays to the patient. I think that the alternative, which is on the way, is not going to be introduced until 2 or 3 years, because the only alternative for AV regimen seems to be another BTK, second-generation BTK inhibitor, zanubrutinib, with a sonrotoclax, which might be even a more potent BCL2 inhibitor. And although we have a preliminary results on that, the randomized study is just only starting, and there will be no readout for the next 2 or 3 years. Now, talking about this time-limited therapies, perhaps one comment of mine, that if we have a patient with a relatively young who wants 100% of his life back, definitely time-limited approach is the best option. Although it's perhaps more bothering during the treatment time, we do have the possibility of a long period of relatively normal life, perhaps even without immunity impairment after the therapy has ended. So such a patient may have 100% of their life back after the therapy. Now, if we go for a long-lasting therapy, which may be even better tolerated, then even a tablet a day may cause some immune problems, may cause an increased number of infections. Such a patient, although will have less adverse events, will not have 100% of his life back. Therefore, Amplify seems to be a very important study.
So, Jennifer, I pulled this comment that you made on that recording that I did with you when you did the presentation. I just want to ask you about a couple of things that you mentioned there. First, the fact that you said that you're using AV, and of course now it's approved, and many patients who in the past you gave continuous BTK inhibitors to. Maybe you can comment on that. And also another study that you commented on, the FLAIR data, which maybe you can talk about what that is. But I wasn't aware of the fact that you don't see BTK mutations, or you saw less BTK mutations there in the time-limited, potential advantage there. Any further comments about, again, your clinical use of AV, particularly in people who used to get continuous BTK inhibitors, and also this issue of BTK resistance?
Right. So, you know, many of the older patients don't necessarily want to come to clinic as much as is required to do an early venetoclax ramp up or with Venobin. That's actually 8 consecutive weeks where they have to come to clinic 1 or 2 days a week. And so many opt for continuous BTK inhibitors just for the simplicity. But I think now with AV, it's much more appealing because the cytoreduction with the acala is very easy. First 2 months, they feel better quickly. And then when they do the venetoclax ramp up, it's not as difficult because of the cytoreduction from the acala first. So more patients are open to it, and then that allows them to get off therapy when they finish the 14 months. Now, the FLAIR trial, I think, is very important because it's actually our first demonstration that time-limited therapy can improve progression-free, and in the case of FLAIR, also overall survival compared to continuous BTK inhibitor. So that was really a very striking result, and that was achieved with an MRD-guided regimen, though, and I think we'll discuss more about MRD guidance as we move into the program, but that's an up-and-coming feature. The other thing that was presented at ASH from FLAIR that was notable was, for the first time, there was an analysis looking at BTK resistance mutations on continuous BTK as compared to the ibrutinib venetoclax arm. And what was found is that mutations did occur in the continuous arm, but they didn't see any BTK mutations in the ibrutinib venetoclax arm. So that suggests, although the numbers are still relatively small, that what we think about time-limited regimens, namely that they may prevent the development of resistance because you have two drugs together, it's hard to get mutations that result in resistance to the two drugs together. And then you stop them, you remove the selection pressure for resistance. And this is the first data that actually supports that that rationale may be true. And so that's very important.
So Wojciech, again, another big highlight of the ASH meeting were the two trials looking at pirtobrutinib in the upfront setting. You presented some of the data there. Can you talk about what we learned at ASH from these trials and what you think it means in terms of clinical practice and future clinical research?
Well, perhaps I will start from another study also published at JCO 2025, namely the five-year follow-up of the BRUIN Phase 1 and 2 protocol. This is important, although that's in relapsing refractory setting, because these are the first five-year-long observations of this drug, not revealing any new safety signals and allowing for over 50% of overall survival at 5 years and 20%. And 14 to 20% of progression-free survival, depending whether the patients were previously exposed to BCL2 or not. However, on ASH meeting, there were two nice presentations in earlier lines. The FREE13 study, which was a combination of a comparison between pirtobrutinib and bendamustine and rituximab, and that was in treatment-naive cohort. We randomized over 280 patients, and to our astonishment, we not only were able to demonstrate at 24 months a significant progression-free survival difference with 94 versus 70% in favor of pirtobrutinib, but also we observed a trend which is statistically not mature but important in overall survival difference, leading us to conclusion that taking a very safe and effective drug in monotherapy to the first line might be the case. Specifically for the elderly or elderly comorbid patients. Now, further proof that it might be the right thing to do is the comparison of pirtobrutinib versus ibrutinib in a randomized BRUIN 314 study. And part of the patients were treated in the first line. And actually, the difference between pirto and ibrutinib-treated patients in the first line is even greater than the one observed in relapsing refractory population. Difference in terms of progression-free survival. And all that in literally excellent tolerance, as pirtobrutinib is the best tolerated BTK inhibitor we have, and possibly the most selective one.
So we'll get into more in terms of pirtobrutinib, in terms of relapse disease. But Jennifer, I was just kind of curious about your thoughts about these data presented in treatment-naive patients. Where do you think this is heading? Are there situations right now, we hear people bringing up the issue, like Wojciech just did, of older patients with comorbidity. Are there situations right now where if you could, or maybe you are, using pirtobrutinib in the first line?
I have not been. I think we still need to be cautious for the majority of our patients. It's true that even now I would consider it for a very much older patient with significant comorbidities, because I agree that it does appear to be the best tolerated of our BTK inhibitors. But I would be very hesitant for younger patients because the follow-up is still very short, only 2 years for progression-free survival in the pirtobrutinib versus ibrutinib and pirtobrutinib versus BR studies. And, you know, with our current paradigm, we can get patients 9 to 10 years with a covalent BTK inhibitor and then another couple of years with pirtobrutinib. There's a risk, because of the nature of the mutations that occur with pirtobrutinib, that if we use it first, patients may develop mutations that will prevent them from getting covalent inhibitors later. So we would need pirtobrutinib to be as good as the covalent inhibitors plus the use of pirtobrutinib after the covalent inhibitors, if that turns out to be the case. And right now our follow-up is much shorter than that. So I think caution is still warranted till we understand the resistance mechanisms.
But I absolutely agree with you, because I would never recommend pirtobrutinib as the standard of care for the younger patient, not comorbid, from the group that wants 100% of his life back. First, a time-limited therapy is suffering a more predictable response. And secondly, we can possibly repeat the same therapy after relapse, specifically the late one. But my point is that if we have the elderly population, which in the life perhaps will have just one line of therapy, pirtobrutinib as a very well-tolerated drug and relatively easy to use might be the option. And so it might be for the patients who have to travel a long time to the university center. It might be that in a community setting, the choices will be slightly different than we will make in our institutions.
That's true. But the second generation covalent BTKs are also pretty easy to give to most patients.
So let me just bring up also, I always find it so informative. I love the trials in progress posters that a lot of meetings have, ESMO and ASCO, et cetera. And I just, here's a list of some of the major phase three trials in the upfront setting that are going on. And I want to just bring up a couple of them. We could spend a long time talking about them. But Jennifer, you're the PI on a big phase three trial the Alliance group is about to do. This is the fourth one down there. Continuous zanubrutinib versus time-limited zanu-sonrotoclax. When I saw that, I was like, wow, that is pretty interesting. Can you talk a little bit about the design of the study and how you ended up utilizing Zanu and sonrotoclax in this study?
Right. So, you know, CLL17 uses ibrutinib, which we're not really using very much anymore in the United States. And there is the issue of the prior Alliance trial, which was during the COVID pandemic, had a lot of toxicity on the combination arm compared to the continuous ibrutinib arm. So we felt that it was important to evaluate time-limited versus continuous therapy again in the older patient population with a much better tolerated BTK inhibitor. And in this case, it's also with a BCL2 inhibitor that has a much easier ramp-up in this study. There are a variety of different ramp-ups that are being studied for sonrotoclax, but in this study, it's over 2 months, and the visits are actually pretty minimal, just a day at the start, a day the week after, and then at the next month and the month after. So it's pretty easy. And the design is 2-to-1 randomization, 2 out of 3 patients for zanu-sonrotoclax and 1 out of 3 patients for continuous zanubrutinib. On the zanubrutinib-sonrotoclax, they get a 3-month lead-in as usual, and then a year of combined therapy. At the end of that time, there's an MRD evaluation, and patients who are undetectable stop. Patients who still have detectable MRD will be randomized to receive a second year of the Zanocin Rotaclax versus to stop. And so we hope that by having one additional MRD time point, we can pull in some of those benefits of the complicated MRD guidance in FLAIR, for example, but with a simplified approach that would be easy to implement in practice down the line.
Yeah, FLAIR, I think they looked at the time it took to become MRD negative, and then the therapy was given for twice that length, which I guess is a little tricky to do in a study, but I think it's very interesting. Any comments, Wojciech, in terms of these ongoing studies, particularly right above that one, you see an interesting, you don't see this too much combining, comparing agents directly. So we see sonrotoclax zanu versus, you know, Amplify, Acala, Ven. Any comments, any predictions, any thoughts about what we're going to see in that study? Wojciech, how do you see, and this is a question I was going to ask later, but I think I'll just bring it up right now. I asked both of you to kind of try to give me your best thoughts in terms of indirectly comparing, you know, Zanu and Acala and sonrotoclax and venetoclax. And here we're going to see a combination of two time-limited approaches there. Any comments, Wojciech, in terms of where do you think this is heading?
Well, I mean, we will look for the results. Potentially, they are fascinating, not because of zanubrutinib, but because of sonrotoclax. Because if it is 14-fold more potent, as some of us postulate, if it's 6-fold more selective, and therefore, which might even has even less adverse events than venetoclax, if it has a shorter half-life allowing, as Jennifer mentioned, for a much easier ramp-up. If it overcomes certain venetoclax mutations, this might be the compound which will make the true difference. I do not believe in superiority of any of the second-generation BTK inhibitor one over the other. They are very, very similar, despite of the the variety of preclinical data showing the IC50 concentration or whatever, which are supposed to be better for zanubrutinib. But in clinical practice, I truly doubt it really matters. For the combination, that's a different story, and we'll see. We look very much, we are very much interested. But in first, we will be very much interested in fully implementing implementing a V regimen in a real world setting, and not just in the clinical studies.
Right. That problem is even worse for the zanubrutinib and sonrotoclax, because right now the data that we have with that is really from a relatively small study done mostly at CLL centers. We don't have any phase 3 data yet. But it looks amazing in terms of the rate of undetectable MRD being quite high compared to what we see with other BTK-BCL2 inhibitor combinations. So it'll be interesting to see if that is maintained in phase 3 trials.
But I think also that we have two different worlds. Our institutions, where we are very keen on performing MRD analysis and we are fascinated by the results, and the community hospitals or the community practices where MRD is rather difficult, they don't use it, and in fact, they will not use it unless we can produce them a clear proof that it's clinically justified in terms of an overall survival difference.
Right. Well, FLAIR just showed that. Although I agree with you, but it is moving into community practice in the United States because we have an FDA-certified next-generation sequencing assay for MRD, which has become easier and has made it more accessible. And there are now a couple of regimens that are listed in the NCCN guidelines. So we may be moving that way.
It would also be interesting to see how the ramp-up plays out in actual practice, community practice. Sounds like it's easier. You wonder whether some patients who right now are going to BTK because it looks too complicated to go through the ramp-up with venetoclax, maybe some of them might do well with sonrotoclax. Well, I'm going to jump in with some of the many questions that I think come up. I'm seeing a lot of these same questions in the chat room coming out. I hear these all the time. So here we go. So Wojciech, I want to start out with you. How should MRD assays be used right now in community practice? Docs are hearing you all talk about the cases where you're looking at MRD. What do you think should be done right now? When should MRD assays be done? Which type of MRD assay should be done? What value? I know there are different, you know, levels of MRD. How do you look at that? And when should MRD assays be done? Wojciech?
My question will be dubious. I would say that if someone wants to run the patients with MRD assays, they should be referred to the reference center. For the community setting, I understand that you have in the States even a better system, which is easier, more feasible. But in Europe, I truly doubt it's a good, the community center is a good setting for the proper MRD testing. So I think that I would say that MRD is important in certain subset of patients, which we want to treat more in a more sophisticated way. But at least in Poland, it will be reserved for the reference centers.
That's a great point. Jennifer, what about here in the United States? Again, we see investigators using MRD and changing what they do outside a clinical trial in some situations. What about community-based docs? For anybody who's going to use an MRD assay, which assay do you recommend? What value are you looking for? And when is the most important times to test for MRD, particularly in the time-limited situation?
Right. So, you know, where it's mostly used at the moment is mostly at the end of treatment, say at the end of a year of venetoclax and obinutuzumab for prognostic purposes. But as I mentioned, there are a few MRD-guided regimens that are now in the NCCN guidelines and where one could potentially modify therapy, although I think that's only really starting to happen outside trials, even in the main centers. Our historic data with MRD is mostly at a level of one cell in 10 to the minus 4 using a validated flow cytometry method. However, that method has never been authorized by the FDA because of the difficulty with standardization of the flow cytometry. And so as a result, there has been a tendency of the FDA in particular to require that people use the FDA-authorized next-generation sequencing assay, the ClonoSeq assay. Now, that should still probably be at a 10 to the minus 4 level on bone marrow or blood, but we are, for some of the trials, investigating using 10 to the minus 5 in blood in lieu of bone marrow because there's thought to be about a one log difference. So the issue with this NGS assay is it's not as well validated and we don't have the same experience with it in trials, but it is probably how MRD will start to be used in the community in the U.S.
And so there are possible patients who will never be happy unless we do everything, including MRD, and they will be fascinating about the results. They will be keen to undergo sequential testing and so on. And there will be those patients who will just like to have done as few procedures as possible and just keep on going. And perhaps for those patients, more of them would be treated in community medicine. And perhaps for those patients, MRD is not that important.
So, Jennifer, let's talk about high-risk situations, particularly del-17P and P53, and also both. You made a comment when we were met before that the so-called two-hit patients have a worse prognosis. I'm curious how that factors into the way you manage these patients. What about patients with complex cytogenetics? And how do you factor in IGVH status, particularly if somebody has, you know, for example, del-17P or P53? And, you know, you hear everybody seems to be oriented around BTK continuous treatment, particularly for del-17P, P53. Do you buy into that? And again, you hear a lot of people saying there's a lot more data with zanubrutinib and they may prefer it there. So So any comments about how you look at high-risk disease, Jennifer, and do you ever use time-limited therapy in that situation?
Right. So obviously, highest-risk disease is deletion 17p or p53. And when I see a patient with those markers, I put together a profile of the patient based on coexisting markers that are associated with outcomes. So if a patient has 17p, which is the most common thing, then the question is, do they have a p53 mutation as well? Do they have multiple p53 mutations as well? That would be adverse. Do they have complex cytogenetics, which would be adverse? Do they have unmutated IGBH, which would be adverse? And so many of the patients have all of those. And then if they have a high-risk clinical presentation as well, I would consider them to be amongst our highest-risk patients. So, you know, in general, it's still the case that continuous BTK inhibitor tends to be favored for these patients based on some of the long-term follow-up data that we have, 6 or 7 years with 65-70% of patients still progression-free on continuous BTK inhibitor. If I am using continuous BTK inhibitor, I do tend to use zanubrutinib just because we have a larger experience of patients treated with zanubrutinib who do have 17p deletion. Now, more recently, I've been considering time-limited treatment. We did a study led by Dr. Davids of acalabrutinib, venetoclax, obinutuzumab, which was MRD-guided treatment for 17p deleted patients. And their outcomes were really pretty good, but they were not as good as people without 17p deletion. The 4-year progression-free survival was 70% versus over 90%. So, you know, I think we're still learning how it might be best to apply time-limited therapy to this patient population, and it's likely going to be combinations of BTK-BCL2 with or without an antibody and maybe also MRD-guided.
So Wojciech, anything you want to add to that, particularly this question of whether or not continuous BTK should be used? For example, you have a patient who's unmutated, who has complex cytogenetics, but who doesn't have P53 or DEL17P. What would you do in that situation? Any other comments about high risk?
I absolutely agree what was already mentioned by Jennifer. Now, from my perspective, there is one thing we have to have in mind. We learned that chemoimmunotherapy is not an option for 17p deleted patients very early. And therefore, in all of the studies, we excluded these patients. Because just in Sequoia study, we had a zanubrutinib versus bendamustine rituximab and an additional arm C, where we just took 17p deleted patients. In most of the other studies, arm C was missing. Therefore, in fact, we have a relatively long-lasting experience with time-indefinite BTK inhibitors and relatively few data on combination therapies and definitely few data on prolonged observation with combination therapies, although this is being gradually filled. So if I had a patient with a high-risk patient, as elegantly described by Jennifer, I would most likely try to treat him in a time-definite regimen combining BTK and BCL2 inhibitor, but I understand the reasoning for the continuous BTK inhibitor therapy. And just to make the picture more complex, I remember one of the studies when we used venetoclax in a time-indefinite manner in 17p-deleted patients and in a relapsing refractory setting, and they've done pretty nicely. Therefore, the prolonged therapy has a prolonged observation time.
So Jennifer, you know, those results that you were just referring to with the AVO that you all did at Dana-Farber were really impressive. Any thoughts about this strategy that was looked at MD Anderson, reported at ASH, looking at delayed use of obinutuzumab? You know, obviously obinutuzumab has its own issues. You might want to comment on that in terms of infection. But here they used MRD to determine whether or not to use it. First, they treated with AV and then see whether or not what happens with their MRD and deciding whether to use obinutuzumab. Can you comment on what they saw there and whether you think this is a reasonable strategy moving forward in the future?
Right. So, you know, after AV, the rates of undetectable MRD with a year of therapy are relatively low. So in that study, most of the patients then got obinutuzumab, and the outcomes were similar whether they did obinutuzumab in a delayed fashion on that arm or they did it earlier in the other arm. And we learned from Amplify, done during the COVID pandemic, that really the patients getting CD20 antibodies were at risk for death from COVID and for higher grade infections. And I think that study really brought it to our attention, in particular the AVO arm of Amplify. And so with the MD Anderson delayed approach, they had less neutropenia, less infections. And so I think if you had a patient that you wanted to give the three-drug therapy to, perhaps because they had high-risk disease, unmutated disease, then if they are older or have some comorbidities, an approach would be to consider delaying the obinutuzumab and see how they do, both in terms of response and toxicity. And then you can consider adding it later when the toxicity might be less. But it seemed, at least from that study, that the benefit was probably similar.
Perhaps one more comment about Amplify and COVID, because we've done a more profound analysis of this, analyzing the waves of COVID and the vaccination status. And it occurred that those who were vaccinated did very much better in terms of mortality. And the other interesting issue was that it worked even in the patients who had just vaccinated weeks before initiating therapy. Therefore, although we had a very bitter lesson on COVID and triplets, we also have a very clear message that CLL is not a disease where we have to initiate therapy right away. So perhaps we should readdress the question and vaccinate the patients even before initiating therapy if we want to go for a more vigorous therapy regimen.
Very interesting idea. Let's talk a little bit about relapse refractory disease. And first, Jennifer, can you comment about your usual approach to patients with disease progression on a BTKI? You always go with venetoclax and anti-CD20, or would you consider pirtobrutinib? How do you make that decision? Any comments?
I usually will still go with venetoclax, and I use obinutuzumab as the CD20 because it is a more potent antibody, and we can generally access it in the United States. The cases where I might use pirtobrutinib are, again, where the patients may have more comorbidities or are older. They can't come into the hospital for the venetoclax ramp-up, which can be more challenging in the patients with progression on BTK because they often have a significant disease burden. We're going to need data really comparing whether it's better to use pirtobrutinib or venetoclax next in patients with progression on covalent BTK, because it is hard to assess from non-comparative data whether a decrease in response to, say, pirtobrutinib in patients who've had venetoclax before as well is just because they've had another line of therapy and they're more heavily pretreated, or if there's something biologic there. I should say also, one of the reasons I favor venetoclax in this setting is because I think it may be helpful for patients who have resistance mutations, that there might be the possibility to reshape the architecture of the disease and before giving another BTK inhibitor, which may allow improved benefit from the BTK inhibitor later if you've suppressed some of the mutations that could otherwise grow out quickly.
And Wojciech, any comments on that? Again, patients progressing on a covalent BTKI, but also patients with disease progression after receiving time-limited venetoclax obinutuzumab. Do you go to a BTK? Which one? And what about repeat rechallenge with venetoclax CD20?
Well, Cater and colleagues published last year in Blood the 10-year update of Murano. I somehow called it a victory under Murano because that was the first randomized study showing the efficacy of venetoclax and rituximab. Hazard ratio 0.23 here, so pretty good. against bendamustine and rituximab. However, I absolutely agree that if I were allowed to, I would use obinutuzumab. Because in Europe at the moment, the situation is illogical. We use venetoclax with obinutuzumab, which is evidently a better monoclonal in first line, as approved. And we're using rituximab with venetoclax in the second line. So the true question for me would be, if I had a choice of how long will I use obinutuzumab, just like described in the first line protocol for a year, but just like in Murano protocol, replacing rituximab for 2 years. Maybe so, Jennifer, the other comment I have is that in Poland, we have a fancy situation where most of the patients first line are not treated by BTK inhibitor, but by BCL2 inhibitor with obinutuzumab. Therefore, in our relapsing refractory setting, most of our patients are relapsing refractory after Venobi regimen.
Jennifer, what about the patient with both exposure to BTKI and BCL2, and also patients who are refractory? So we'll start out maybe with a patient who has to stop a BTKI because of toxicity, then gets treated with venetoclax CD20, and then disease progression. How do you decide whether to go to a different BTKI or some other strategy if they haven't progressed on the BTKI?
Yeah, if they haven't progressed on the BTKI, I would use a BTKI because, and this is really the key point, exposure is not the same as resistance. And so you can usually go back to a drug that they may have been exposed to that they're not refractory to, as long as, they didn't have a intolerance that, like a subarachnoid hemorrhage or something, where you wouldn't use a BTK.
Wojciech, what about the double refractory patient? How do you think that through? Where does pirtobrutinib come in, and also CAR-T?
I would again quote Jennifer that double exposed doesn't mean double refractory. And usually we know that the patient is refractory to BTK inhibitor, but exposed to BCL2 inhibitor. Therefore, I wouldn't cross BCL2 inhibitors in a patient exposed previously to this class of drug. Now, talking about pirtobrutinib, it was officially approved for patients relapsing or refractory to both. The proof comes from the BRUIN phase 1/2 study, but we also did a confirmational study published last year in JCO, where we evidently could prove that pirtobrutinib was better in terms of progression-free survival against Idela rituximab or bendamustine rituximab. The comparator arm was Medicare, but we couldn't find anything better. Now, the overall survival difference was not the primary target, as majority, namely 76% of the patients, had an effective crossover. But despite the crossover, there was a numerical superiority in overall survival. Therefore, pirtobrutinib is fully justified in this double-exposed patients. The question is, should we do something else, and what should we do after pirtobrutinib as the responses are not dramatically lengthy? We are talking about the median progression-free survival of 14 months.
So, Jennifer, again, any comments on pirtobrutinib? Also, as we see BTK degraders coming along, where do you see them factoring in, and how do you compare the efficacy against various BTK mutations in patients with disease progression on covalent BTKI? Do you think we're going to be using pirtobrutinib or BTK degraders or both in sequence?
Well, I hope we'll be able to use both in sequence. It's hard to tell, but we are moving to a place where we will probably need to profile the mutations that come up in order to decide which drug to use. We don't yet really know the full profile of resistance with BTK degraders, but the one described mutation was an A428D mutation, which appears to confer resistance to all of our drugs. And so if that is a more common mutation after BTK degraders, then we're going to need to keep them reserved for later line because we don't want to be selecting that mutation before we've used our other drugs. So that's something that we still need to understand better.
But at least one of the companies has confidence in BTK degraders as it's planning to run in a double refractory or double exposed patients a randomized study with the third generation BTK inhibitor versus BTK degrader.
Yeah, they're both doing that, actually. They're both going head-to-head against Pirto. So that's actually excellent, right? Because we'll get good data from that.
Jennifer, what about CAR-T? When do you think about that?
I have to say, I try not to think about it in CLL unless I'm really in a dire place. Because right now, I feel that the data are not that great, to be honest. You know, with CAR-T liso-cel alone, the complete response rate's about 20%. With ibrutinib beforehand, it was about 40%. But in order to get a really good benefit from the CAR-T procedure, you do have to have a CR because we see that the other patients are relapsing fairly quickly. Like a partial response gets you 2 years, basically, which is not too different from pirtobrutinib, but it's a lot harder to go through the CAR-T procedure. So I'm hoping that, you know, in the next 5 years, we'll see a lot of improvements in our approach to CAR-T in CLL so that it will feel like it has a higher long-term benefit rate than what we're seeing so far.
So I want to finish out actually with a case I see here in the chat room, Wojciech from Wendy, who has a patient who was started on Amplify, acalabrutinib and venetoclax, but then after a few months of therapy was diagnosed with thymic carcinoma. So her therapy was interrupted in order to have a treatment for this other cancer. And now the patient's recovered from that, and she's trying to figure out where to head in clinically in complete remission, but wonders whether or not she should get an MRD assay to try to figure out what to do at this point. I guess kind of an unusual one-off situation. But if you found that she was MRD negative at this point, Wojciech, would you be okay just following her, or would you go put her back on therapy?
Well, I would perhaps even consider a delay of therapy even in MRD-positive patients without any clinical symptoms for one reason. If the patient had a secondary primary malignancy, which we should address perhaps like that, then even if we regard the other malignancy well attended and treated, we still need all the immunity the organism has to fortify the action against the SPM. And however, whatever our therapy for CLL would be, it will undermine the efficacy of the immune system. So I would just try to delay CLL therapy as long as possible.
A really interesting perspective. I'll finish out and let you give another second opinion, Jennifer, on this case. Any thoughts?
So I actually agree. When patients have to stop a therapy for an intolerance, or in this case for second malignancy, if they're in a clinical complete remission or even just in a good response, I'll often just try to give them a break and wait until the disease progresses again and then reevaluate at that point what treatment is optimal. And in this case, I would not use MRD. It's actually not very likely the patient has undetectable MRD, but they may still have some sustained response even with detectable MRD. We do see that with BTK-BCL2 combinations.
So, Wendy, I hope that was helpful to you. And Jennifer and Wojciech, thank you so much for working with me before this to record your presentation and also to participate in this webinar. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Jennifer. Thanks so much, Wojciech. Have a good one.